thanks be to God.
See their kids. Last week, someone said to me, "Are you nervous about next week?" This is from a friend of mine who asked me this question while we were standing up on Narrow Gauge watching Sam and some of the other racers race Super G on Wednesday down Narrow Gauge. And she said to me, "Are you nervous about next week?" And I said, "Next week? What's next week?" I felt like a bad parent because I had missed the cues and I really didn't know what was going on. So I faked it and I said, "No, not really. Next week." Evidently, the big bad boy downhill is at Sugarloaf this week. The Eastern Cup downhill. But I really wasn't that worried because I had no idea. And my poor friend, she was so anxious already. But I have to say, last Sunday I was skiing down the headwall and I thought to myself, you know, I really encourage my kids to race down this slope and breakneck speeds. What am I thinking? And I stand there at the G. Lewis building and I watch them come around the headwall on a big race like that, and they make like two turns on the headwall. I make like 20. You know, and I sidestep a lot. And two things came to mind as I stood there, honest to gosh, going down the headwall last Sunday. Two things came to mind. One is something that someone said to me recently, which I get a chuckle out of, and I don't know where it comes from, but I do love it. Someone just said, "It's not really ice unless there are fish swimming underneath it." Do you know who that is? Sounds like Dave Barry. The other one here is Dave Barry, and this was handed to me by a friend who lives on the coast and does not ski, and so has great admiration for me, but also thinks perhaps I'm a little nuts. And she handed me this. You've probably heard it. I put it on my desk. "Skiing is an exciting winter sport, but it's not for everybody. For example, it is not for sane people." Sane people look at skiing and they say, "Wait a minute! I'm supposed to attach slippery objects to my feet and get on a frozen chair dangling from a scary-looking wire, and then get dumped off on a snow-covered slope so steep that the mountain goats are wearing seatbelts, and then, if by some miracle I'm able to get back down without killing myself, they say I'm supposed to do it again?" Stay very quiet. So as regards this whole like skiing thing, and those of you who know me, you know my kids go wicked fast, they go wicked fast down the hill. I don't know, the Super G the other day, they say you hit like 60 or 61, but that's nothing compared to this week. And on most days, I think I live in a state of pleasant denial about what it is my kids are doing. But every day, I pray for their safety, and I do entrust them into the hands of God. People who are parents know exactly this kind of thing that I'm talking about. It could be skiing, it could be anything. But your kids go out in the world, and they do just crazy stuff. If you're not a parent, you have no idea what I'm talking about, and you can't really make the mental leap, and don't worry about it, you know. Live in blissful ignorance. Don't sweat. But we read this story about a father and a son today. A scary story. And there are lots of questions. I hope you have questions about this story. Anybody have questions about this story? Yeah? Anybody want to throw out some of your questions about the story before I get to mine? Anybody was burning with a question? If I don't get to your question, make sure you tell it to me later. Because for me, I come up with a lot of questions in this story. In this story, Abraham is asked by God to make the ultimate sacrifice. At least as a parent, I would say it's the ultimate sacrifice. He's asked to make the ultimate sacrifice twice. Twice. The first time, Sarah starts it. "Get rid of that slave woman and her son, for that slave woman's son will never share in the inheritance with my son Isaac." Nothing's worse than a jealous mother, except perhaps a jealous wife. You have to remember, though, it was Sarah's idea to give her concubine to Abraham in the first place. She was getting anxious that she hadn't gotten pregnant. She had a right to be anxious, I'll grant you that. But she's the one that gave Hagar the concubine to Abraham and said, "Hey, if
If I'm not going to be able to do this, come up with a child for us. But now that she has her own boy, oh, she's singing a different tune, isn't she? And then there's Abraham. You wonder, is he henpecked? I don't know. But he is distressed, and rightly so, because Ishmael is his son. Even if he is not Sarah's son, Ishmael is Abraham's son. Don't make him off to be somebody else. He's his kid. God promised Abraham his descendants would be many and a blessing to the world. And so he doesn't want to turn his back on God's blessing. I mean, is Ishmael a blessing from God or a curse? Because he is not Sarah's. I mean, last time I checked, all children are gifts from God. So we've got a little bit of a quandary here. There are no evil children. Children are a blessing. Yes, some of them come with a lot of baggage. But that wasn't Ishmael's fault. So he's in this awful, he's distressed. The text said Abraham is distressed, and he should be. God finally says, do not be distressed about the boy and your maidservant. I will make the son of the maidservant into a nation also because he is your offspring. He's saying, don't worry. I got it. I'll handle it. I'll handle it. You handle your wife. I'll handle Ishmael. And do recall that Islam, the religion of Islam, claims lineage from Abraham through Ishmael. So he's very important in the story. Now, I believe in the Quran, and don't quote me on this, but I believe in the Quran, it's actually Ishmael who sacrificed and not Isaac, so the story varies from here, but the key point is that Islam, as we know it, traces itself through Ishmael. So he's an important character. So here we have Abraham, trusting God, kind of basically kicking Hagar and Ishmael out of the house, out of the tent, with a sack of food and a bottle of water. No camel, no servants to serve them or protect them. Frankly, I think Abraham did that a little bit poorly. God said, okay, you can let her go, but he didn't say, go out and send them out into the desert to die. And I have to wonder, this is one of my questions, is this negligence a sign of trust in God, or is it pressure from Sarah? I don't know. I think it's an interesting question, though. God didn't say to send them out in the wilderness to die, but, I mean, food, water, no help, no camel, nothing. They're in the middle of the Philistines. Hello? We are fortunate that God does indeed care deeply about Hagar and about Ishmael, and so much so that God speaks directly to Hagar. Don't miss that. You and I who have been waiting all our lives to hear a word from the Lord, he speaks to Hagar, and he says, don't be afraid for your son. I will make him into a great nation. He does survive. He grows up. He ends up with a wife from Egypt. Remember, Hagar is also Egyptian. And you wonder, does we know that part of the story? Does Abraham know that part of the story? Does Abraham know what happens to Ishmael? These are the questions I ask. I don't know what to say. I want to know. So Abraham has just lost a son deliberately of his own volition. He is just, his chances of an heir surviving to adulthood has just been cut in half. Those of you who have had two children, imagine what it would be like to say goodbye to one. Gloss over it. Sometime later, it says, God tests Abraham when he commands, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about. Now, we can get into all kinds of technicalities here. This is one of those ones. If you go and read the commentaries, you're going to be 30 pages before they ever get to anything. I'm going to try and boil it down at least to a couple of salient points for you and I to take home. Suffice it to say that God is testing Abraham to see if he will truly obey the Lord, even when it doesn't make sense, even when it's costly, even when it's painful. I don't believe that God ever intended to sacrifice Isaac, but who knows the mind of God? There was enough child sacrifice going on in that time that Abraham knew it was a possibility. There was a context for this particular test. Child sacrifice was going on all around the neighborhood. Okay? And that's important for us to remember. Other gods were asking this of their adherents. Today, when a parent gets those kind of words from God, we take their children away from them. And we should. There is no context for child sacrifice today. That is not okay, right? Do you remember? And there have been people that have said this. I mean, remember in 19, the one I was thinking was around in the early 90s, a guy named Andrew Tate sacrificed his two-year-old daughter, shot his two-year-old daughter, carried her naked through the streets to his brother's house, believing that if God would then raise her from the dead, it would help convert his brother to Jesus. I mean, it was, people, you know, they still kind of get away with this, but no, there's no, you know, if you get those words, go to the hospital. That's not okay, okay? There's no context for that. God is not going to ask us to do that. I think we can say that with great assurance. We can't really know what God was thinking. His thoughts are not our thoughts. He is so much beyond and above us. But we can reflect on Abraham's thoughts and feelings and actions that can help us in our faith. One thing Abraham does not do, which is interesting, is he does not question God about this. In our little skit, we kind of did a little struggle, but in the text, he does not question this at all. That Abraham is somehow trusting God even when he doesn't understand. Now, frankly, I think that's crazy to me. I don't know and I would question such a command from God. God can handle our doubts. God can handle our questions. I mean, if you're getting something in your head you believe is from the Lord, and it kind of goes against morality, the law, what you know about God, ask twice. Okay? Ask twice. I think God can handle that in our lives. But in the text, there doesn't seem to be any way in which he questions, which I think is kind of interesting. There's also no emotional content in the story. When it comes to Ishmael, it said that Abraham was distressed with the idea of turning on Ishmael. But there's no emotional content relayed in the story of the sacrifice. Now, we know that Abraham loves Isaac. God even says, take your son, the son whom you love. But it's impossible for us not to write our own emotions all over this. I mean, we can't do it. And you see that in the skit. What we can say, though, I think, is that Abraham is walking by faith and not by feelings. Abraham is working by faith and not by feelings. And that is a good word for us. That a lot of times, too many times, we let our feelings drive our decisions. And in matters of faith, there are times when we've got to do what God says to do, even though you don't particularly like it or feel good about it. And as the story is told, Abraham's clearly willing to go through with the sacrifice. Got to remember that. The wood is laid out. The boy is bound. He's laid on the wood. The knife is in his hand. The story is very clear. He has means, motive, and opportunity. It's all there. It's all there. And I have a question about Isaac. What about Isaac? When does he figure out what's going on? When does the light bulb go on? If your father tied you up and laid you on a bonfire stack, wouldn't you protest? Some scholars believe that Isaac understood what was going on and that he also placed his faith in God. That place that says the two of them went together can also say that the two of them went in agreement. And that seems possible to me, and perhaps a little bit more palatable. You have to remember, Abraham was more than 100 years old. Isaac would have been able, certainly, to get away if he chose to, and yet he submits to his father. The Jewish commentators think that Isaac was actually probably around 30, if you read the Jewish commentaries, which is interesting. I think it's important to say, in remembering Abraham's faith, let's also remember Isaac's faith. Because Isaac is agreeing to this on something. He's not 8. The math doesn't work. And the fact that, you know, I mean, most of us just wouldn't stand there while some of us kind of are set to fire. So you have to kind of remember that. Let's not forget Isaac's faith. And I think it is quite probable that Isaac is actually a part of this, which is good, because otherwise he would need therapy forever. Thank you for me. Keep that in mind. I have trouble relating to Abraham here. I don't know about you, but I would be begging. I would be pleading. I would be pouring my heart out to God. I would say, this is the time for bartering. And we know that Abraham is comfortable haggling with God. Back in chapter 18, just a couple of chapters ago, Abraham haggles with God to save the immoral people of Sodom. It's not a story we've covered in on Sunday mornings, but some of you know it. Abraham haggles with God, it's going to destroy the whole town, there's nobody righteous there, and Abraham's saying, if there are 50 righteous people in Sodom, will you really sweep it away and not spare it for the sake of the 50? And God says, okay, it happened. He gets down to 10 people. So Abraham is used to working and pleading with God. Why not here? Now, the politically correct interpretation is supposedly found where Abraham says God himself will provide the lamb for the sacrifice. But I find it odd. What I think is true is this was not so much a test to produce faith as a test to reveal faith. And I think there's a little bit difference there. God is building Abraham slowly, piece by piece, bit by bit, year by year, into a man of faith. God has been training Abraham, bringing him up to this place of great trust. God had just asked Abraham to give up Ishmael in a less severe way, and God used that and used everything else to train up Abraham. This test is especially hard, though, because it seems to contradict everything that we've already known about this previous promise, about the covenant that God has made with Abraham. How can God say one thing and then seemingly demand another? If you want to take anything from this story, here it is, right here. At least for me, this kind of helps me to digest this story and to put it in a context that I can apply to my life. I think Abraham needed to learn the difference between trusting the promise and trusting the promiser. Say it again. The difference between trusting the promise and trusting the promiser. You see, it's always tempting to put God's promise before God himself and God's presence, and then somehow feel that it's our responsibility to bring the promise to pass, even if we have to disobey God to make it work. Something like the ends justify the means. You know, God said this, so by golly, we're going to make it happen. And we force something into being. And I think when we do that, we have forgotten that the big point is that relationship with the one who makes the promise, the promiser. Trust the promiser, no matter what, and that promise will be taken care of. Maybe not in the way you think, or the way that you look, or the way you expect. But we put our faith in the one who makes the promises, not the promise itself. And I think that's an important distinction. Now, one of the reasons that this passage is chosen as one of the top 100 is because we see in it a foreshadowing to the life of Jesus Christ. When God asked Abraham for the ultimate demonstration of love and commitment, he asked for Abraham's son. And when God wanted to show us the ultimate demonstration of his love and commitment, he gave us his son. So that we can say, God, I know that you love me, seeing that you did not withhold your son, your only son, from me. You've heard it put another way. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. If Isaac went willingly, which I believe perhaps that he did, then the connection between Jesus and Isaac becomes even clearer as a metaphor. Both were loved by their father. Both offered themselves willingly. Both carried wood up the hill to the sacrifice. And both were delivered from death, if you check back to the story, on the third day. Interesting foreshadow there, which is really interesting. Also note the name of the hill. Name of the hill. Anybody pick up what he named this place? He didn't name it after Abraham's trial. Named it after God's work. It's called the Lord will provide. We translate it Jehovah Jireh. The song we sang is written in the context of this story. Jehovah Jireh, my provider, his grace is sufficient for me. My God shall supply all my need according to his riches and glory. He puts his angels in charge over me. Jehovah Jireh cares for me. Sing that song again later in the context of this story. The Lord will provide, Jehovah Jireh. So where are you being asked to trust the promiser? Where is the hill named the Lord will provide for you? Where is it is that you need to trust the promiser? Is it with your health, with the well-being of your children, the peace of the nation, the future of this planet, tomorrow's sobriety? Trust the promiser. Abraham was not born full of faith. It grew over time. And as Abraham trusted God, his faith grew. I do believe most times our faith is weak when we trust the promises rather than the promiser. We decide what God needs to do for us, and then we, quote, lose our faith when God did not get on board with our decisions. I mean, when do you lose your faith? When God doesn't do what you want him to do. I have begged God for my kids. I've bartered. I've done all kinds of things for all kinds of things in my life. I'm a passionate person, if you haven't figured that out this past hour. I mean, I am not without emotion. But I need to keep always to step back, which is hard, from telling God what to do. And trust the promiser. To remember the promise, by the way. God never promised us health. God did not promise us wealth. God did not promise us fame. And if we get those, what a great blessing. God did promise us his presence by the Holy Spirit. God has promised us forgiveness and love and mercy. And God has promised that through us, through the descendants of Abraham, we would be a blessing to the world. Those are promises. But ultimately, our faith is in the one who makes the promise. And he'll find a way. He'll find a way. We don't come into the kingdom wrestling and fighting. We come in releasing our lives to the promiser. I do have a song for us to sing as we go into prayer. I just thought it would be a good way for us to enter into prayer together. God will make a way where there seems to be no way. If there are ways in which you like